I want you to believe me, I have no quarrel with the Lord's Prayer. It's just that when you turn me loose only once a month, and I've just come back from Oklahoma City where they do the prayer at a different time, it gets away, and so now, for the benefit of those who feel they haven't been to church, if they don't say the Lord's Prayer in unison, let's do that together. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us the wrongs we have done, as we forgive those who have wronged us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
Good morning. My name is Dick West. I'd like to welcome all of the visitors with us this morning and ask that you kindly sign a guest card and leave it in the pew. Or if none is available, please just sign the bulletin and leave it there, and one of our ushers will pick up. We'd simply like to acknowledge your visit with us this morning. There are a couple of announcements I'd like to bring to your attention. The October 28th Revelations event here in the church, that's a week from tonight, is one of the highlights of our musical season. And for me last year, as a first-time attendee, it was particularly exciting. You get to hear firsthand, close up in an intimate atmosphere, some of the beautiful voices of our choir. So I urge all of you to sign up as soon as possible so they can plan for the meals. The second announcement is actually a correction. The alternative Christmas market is announced in your bulletin to be held on the 17th and 18th of November. The real dates are the 10th and the 11th. Same place as Grace Presbyterian Fellowship Hall on Saturday the 10th and Sunday the 11th. As is customary in the month of October, we ask that a member of the church share his thoughts about what University Congregational Church means to him. Today, Bill Park is. We're honored to have Bill Park do that for us.
Good morning. When Diane and I were first invited to attend the first meeting of our yet-unnamed church in 1983, we were happy to be included. We had only recently become new members of Plymouth Congregational Church when things changed and Bob Myers moved on. Diane and I realized Bob Myers' way with words, his ability to make sense out of things that before had seemed uninteresting or unclear, was the church experience we wanted to follow. We had found a place where ideas were presented in a way that was understandable. I found myself looking forward to Sundays. I'm sure there are other churches that could make me feel comfortable, but few that could make me feel at home like I do here. Here at UCC, no one claims to own the truth. We are given direction by Gary or Bob, and usually a light goes on in the congregation's collective consciousness. We might not all accept the message in the same way, but that is not important here. Because I have been led to listen better and understand more, I have been happy to participate in the life of this church. I'm grateful to have UCC to support, and I hope you can have as warm a feeling for this church as I do. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Would the ushers please come forward? When the Apostle Paul taught the early church how to give, he said, each person should give as planned and on a voluntary basis. There should be no reluctance, no sense of compulsion. It is hoped that the value of this church in your life will make you wish to support it. May what we have returned in thankfulness for our own blessings be an appropriate token of our Christian faith and of our appreciation for the work done by this church. Amen.
On a certain day, when some of the religious hardliners in ancient Israel were grumbling about the amount of time Jesus spent in the company of social outcasts, he told them what someone has called the most divinely tender and most humanly touching story ever told. I would like to add that it's also a scathing indictment of religious conceit, which means that every parishioner and every preacher should hear it at least once a year. We are several years overdue, so please join me in getting reacquainted with a story that never goes out of date. There was once a man with two sons, Jesus told his critics, and one day the younger boy said, "I want my share of the property, and I want it right now." It's not hard to imagine how he worked himself up to that moment. In the farm fields, on his walks, in his bedroom at night, he has been talking to himself. "I've got to get away from this dull place and have some fun while I'm still young enough to enjoy it. Otherwise, I'm going to miss out on all the good stuff." He's positive there must be a better life out there someplace in what the story calls the far country, an unforgettable phrase for whatever place promises freedom and excitement. When Rudyard Kipling, of the Jungle Book fame, read this story, he decided that the boy's older brother may have been one of his reasons for wanting to leave. This one, whom I have nicknamed Sour Sam, we shall meet in a few minutes in an ugly fit of envy and self-righteousness. A man who stays in his pew and does all the things expected of him, but apparently without much joy ever in the doing of them. I've met this man. I'm sure you have. Respectable, but cold, a bit too proud of himself, quick to build himself up by finding fault in others. He wouldn't have been much fun to work with. But whatever his list of reasons for leaving home, the younger brother finally makes the big announcement to his father. "I want to see the world, be my own boss, find out what it's like to be free." The father probably has a good idea what is likely to happen, may even have done the same thing himself once and learned the truth that absolute freedom ends up in absolute misery. There must be some father listening who knows there's nothing on earth more frustrating than a son who has hatched a grand scheme to conquer the world when you know he hasn't the foggiest idea what the world is all about. If Sour Sam is present to hear his brother's announcement, I can almost hear his pious advice. "You know, of course, that if you were a decent sort at all, you'd stay here and help me work. You will never find me wanting to run off and throw my money and my life away like a fool." And across the table, the younger boy, who at this time in his life could fairly be called Good Time Charlie, stares down at the tablecloth and thinks, "Oh, God, anything to keep from being like him." The stories Jesus told were always quick and to the point, so the father makes no effort to stop his son from leaving. He divides the inheritance between the two boys and says goodbye to the rebel. Home, after all, is never home to a boy of alien will. All the father can do now is what parents so often learn to do, wait and hope. As for the son that we have learned to call prodigal, there's no doubt about his excitement as he heads off with money in his pocket to what is vaguely called a far country, so it can stand for a dream most of us have entertained. His new friends introduce him to a reckless lifestyle he has hardly dared imagine. Friends who, in their scorn for discipline and hard work, seem so much more fun than the people left behind. Months pass, a few years even, and suddenly one day the money is all gone. A famine hits the country, and the friends discover they have other business which does not include him. Desperate and facing starvation, Good Time Charlie hires himself out to a farmer who gives him a job feeding pigs. Total disgrace for a Jewish boy brought up to call them unclean. The great dream of freedom dies in the dirt of a pigsty. Food is so scarce that he's willing to eat the stuff thrown out for the hogs, but the pig farmers won't even let him do that. And as low now as he can fall, Charlie suddenly gets it. There is no way to be completely free. We are always in bondage to something or someone. Some bondages are more rewarding than others, that's all. And it occurs to Charlie that there was more real freedom in his father's house than he had thought, and that he has left behind the only unconditional and abiding love he can count on. So he gets a confessional speech made up and heads home in his rags, wondering if they'll take him in, hoping he can bear the humiliation. But there is a tender hint that his father has looked down the road 1,000 times, and now, catching sight of his wayward son, runs to meet him. The bit about running may have a special force easy to miss in our Western world. I'm not sure how useful it was for Aristotle to dictate that great men never run in public, but a few centuries later, when this story was told, it was still considered undignified in Eastern eyes for older men to run in public. So Jesus may be deliberately stressing how this welcoming father has abandoned all dignity in the ache of his longing. There is a Buddhist parallel to this story, which has the father put the son through 20 years of tests to prove that he has truly repented. But Jesus seems to know that life punishes us in its own way when we miss the mark, and that what we need then is not quarantine, but acceptance and healing. And then there is André Gide, the French writer, who invents his own ending to the story, in which the son comes back and sends his brother out into the same far country so he too can sow his wild oats and, quote, grow up to become a man. Gide's promise and premise is that you have to renounce God before you can find him, that you have to go out and tarnish the shining image of the heart before you can really know how much it means to get that brightness back. You may wish to consider later how much sense that makes, but this story is not all that sophisticated. So a sadder but wiser Good Time Charlie simply says, Dad, I've made mistakes, and I realize I have no claim on you. I'm not even fit to be called your son, but here I am. Think how many sons and daughters have said it over the years. And this father, like so many others, gives up the chance to say, I told you so, and cuts short the confession with a kiss so he can start the celebration. Servants are told to bring not just any robe to cover the rags, but the one kept in reserve for honored guests, and to come back with a ring as proof of a son's authority, and fresh sandals, because sons do not go barefoot. No word of reproof, no probation, no making sure the personality disease has run its course, which is exactly why this story lies at the very heart of the good news. When many of the other stories are forgotten, this one stays in the mind with its saving vision of someone's waiting love in that crucial moment where we are deciding where it makes sense to live. Beyond our mistakes and disappointments, on the far side of our pretense and our false starts, there is, this immortal story says, the chance and glory of coming home. You and I are meant to remember, in gatherings like this one, that there is always someone who needs our help in finding out how to do that. But the great realist who told this story knew that people who proudly think they've been safely at home all along are sometimes too smug and self-righteous to help anyone. So he uses the second half of this parable to make us take a long, hard look at ourselves. We've known the story of the lost prodigal son since we were kids in Sunday school. But what may be even more important to know is that it features two lost sons, and that those of us who come to church are more at risk of being the second son than the first one. So let's take a look now at Sour Sam. On his way home to dinner after a long day's work in the field, when he suddenly hears the unfamiliar noise of music and dancing, he calls one of the servants to ask, "What's going on?" And the servant says, "Your brother has come home, and your father is celebrating because we have him back, safe and sound." You would expect a brother, if he had any love at all in his heart, to drop the hoe, forget how tired he was, and lunge into that house with so much joy he would practically knock his brother down. But not this man, who is furious. What are they doing? Celebrating the return of a wild kid who has disgraced himself and the whole family? If there's to be a party, it should be for me, the one who stayed home and did everything he was supposed to do. Well, they can have their party. I won't be there. His pout is reported, and the father, who had already run to meet his other son, now takes the initiative again and comes outside to plead with this one, who is kicking the dog and grumbling under his breath about irresponsible kids who run off and do anything they damned well please, and then come home, can you believe it, to a party. "I guess you know," he says to his father, "how I've slaved for you all these years, never once disobeyed your orders, up at the crack of dawn, home late at night, and never once did I get a party like this. Now this son of yours," not my brother, notice, "but this son of yours turns up after wasting his money on bad women and street bums, and you throw a party? The father's reply is all gentleness. Son, you have always been here, and everything I have is yours. But how could we help celebrating this happy day? Your brother was lost to us, and we have him home again. So, did it work, this tender plea? Well, we never find out, because the story ends right here on purpose, so we can ponder how we would have acted. Sour Sam is a legalist, which is to say that he goes through all the right motions with the wrong spirit. He makes me think of some years in my life spent among people whose religion ordered them to be in church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, and any other time the doors were opened. Some went gladly most of the time, but there were others who went only because they were afraid not to, and in their unhappiness, they provoked quarrels and grumbled about others who had not shown up to do their duty as they had. This always seemed a curious thing to me. It was as if they were having to endure some kind of punishment, and they wanted to be sure that others shared their misery. When I began to speak in pulpits, they sometimes asked me to castigate those who had missed on a Sunday or failed to come for Wednesday evening Bible study. It seemed to me that if we had a good thing going, a banquet, a fellowship that counted enormously when we were sick or discouraged, then we'd simply be glad when others came among us. And when they didn't, it would not be resentment we felt, but simply a quiet regret that they had missed something worthwhile. But when goodness is forced, you can blame it for more malicious gossip and more church strife than any other single thing. No wonder Sour Sam couldn't stand the sound of music coming from his house. There hasn't been a song in his heart for years, only the click of a calculator adding up his virtues. Just at this moment, the story ends abruptly, so that as far as we know, self-righteous Sam is still sitting out in the field somewhere, watching happiness from a distance. There is a reason why pride tops the list of the seven deadly sins. So every member of every church, every preacher in every pulpit, needs to ponder the honest response of one student of this story when asked about the identity of the older brother. Who is that self-righteous older brother? I learned it only yesterday. Myself. Not likely true of anyone present this morning, but it never hurts to be reminded.